Slinkin.
Call to order the Business and Labor Committee on May 2nd, 2011. Our first order of business will be opening a hearing on Senate Bill 967.
Mr. Chair, Committee Members, Senate Bill 967 repeals the provisions of Senate Bill 408 from the 2005 session, which governs the adjustment of public utility rates to account for taxes that are paid by electric and natural gas utilities. The measure requires the Public Utility Commission to consider taxes that are paid by electricity and gas, natural gas utilities when considering rate-making proceedings, and also allows the Commission to adjust rates for a utility as part of an affiliated group, and also allows the Commission to consider taxes paid when approving the merger or acquisition of a utility. There is an emergency clause in the measure, effect on passage, and no revenue and fiscal impact.
Very good. Thank you very much. Ready to go?
Yes. Good morning, Co-Chair Kenemer and Schaffner. My name is Susan Ackerman. I'm one of your three public utility commissioners. I'm here in support of Senate Bill 967. There is written testimony, and I don't intend to repeat the testimony. I would note that this bill was a result of a committee that was, or a work group actually, that was assembled by the Senate Business, Transportation, Economic Development Committee. It's co-chaired by Senators Burdick and Atkinson. And a number of parties interested in Senate Bill, the original Senate Bill 408, worked on this bill and came up with this compromise legislation. It included the PUC, customer advocates, the investor-owned utilities that are affected by the bill, industrial customers, business associations, and labor. They met for over a month and came up with this compromise bill. Essentially, what we were trying to do here with this bill was find another way of implementing the intent of the original Senate Bill 408, but in a way that was more transparent and better for the parties overall. There were some very hard compromises made to reach this bill, some very hard by the parties, but they worked very hard on it. In fact, this testimony is compromise testimony by the parties, and so I encourage you, when you have time, to read it.
Compromise.
Okay. Anyway, that is all I intend to say this morning, co-chairs, unless you desire me to answer questions.
Let's see if we have some, and nice to have you here, Commissioner.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Questions or comments?
I appreciate the work group that you put together. Any further questions?
Only to say, Mr. Chair, if I may, that it would be nice to put all this behind us. Because I was here at 408, and it wasn't fun.
Me too, remember? In fact, it was in this committee, wasn't it?
Think any further questions or comments for the commissioner? We appreciate you putting the work group together and coming through with an important fix on this.
Thank you.
Commissioner Ackerman is the only one who signed up initially to hear on to be heard on this. Is there anyone else wishing to speak on this, please?
If you would, we'd like to ask you to keep your comments to about 5 minutes, and let's proceed. Give us your name, and let's proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members, my name is Dan Meek. I have distributed written testimony to the clerk, and I believe that she has distributed that to you. I was one of the primary proponents of Senate Bill 408 in 2005, and I very much oppose this bill today. It would revert rate making for utilities in Oregon back to its pre-2005 situation. That is, it would allow the Oregon Public Utility Commission once again to authorize utilities to charge ratepayers for hundreds of millions of dollars a year for local, state, and federal income taxes that the utilities, in fact, do not pay. Let's recall the situation prior to Senate Bill 408. The utilities at that point, according to an op-ed written by your colleagues, Senator Metzger and Senator Vicky Walker, indicated that the Oregon utilities at that time were charging ratepayers $150 million a year for so-called income taxes that, in fact, the utilities were not paying. This situation had persisted for several years. For Portland General Electric, we know it persisted from 1997 through the year 2005, and in fact also the first quarter of 2006. This was considered an outrage And the bill, Senate Bill 408, was endorsed by virtually every large newspaper in the state, including the Oregonian, the Statesman Journal, the Democrat Herald, and others. What this bill does is that it reverses the central policy decision that was made in Senate Bill 408 of 2005, because it removes the following statement, which is currently in law as a result of that bill. Utility rates that include the amounts for taxes should reflect the taxes that are paid to units of government to be considered fair, just, and reasonable. That central policy statement, combined with the prohibition on rates that are not fair, just, or reasonable, in another section of ORS 757, created a requirement that the private utilities operating in Oregon not charge ratepayers for taxes that they don't actually pay to government. Now, the administration of Senate Bill 408 has left a lot to be desired. The Public Utility Commission did not adopt the automatic adjustment clauses that were required by Senate Bill 408 until they were ordered to do so by Marion County Circuit Court in a lawsuit brought by Utility Reform Project and Ken Lewis, who is now chair of the Oregon Ethics Commission. In addition, the Commission, or Public Utility Commission, then adopted a methodology for attributing income taxes paid by the parent, corporate parent of a utility operating in Oregon that was both amazingly complex and impossible for anyone in Oregon to confirm. They allocated tax payments allegedly made by Berkshire Hathaway based upon Berkshire Hathaway's worldwide revenues, payroll, and property ownership. That information is information that nobody in Oregon could check for accuracy. As a result, Pacific Power and Light under Senate Bill, under the PUC's administration of Senate Bill 408, has actually increased rates rather than decreased them. For other utilities, for example, like Portland General Electric, Portland General Electric has been required to refund $40 million, and that number will double if the Utility Reform Project prevails in a lawsuit that is currently before the Oregon Court of Appeals pertaining to the period, which is the last 3 months of 2005. Despite the written testimony that you've already seen, there is absolutely nothing in Senate Bill, well, first of all, 967 does repeal the requirement that utility taxes in rates be based upon the actual amounts paid to units of government. And nowhere in Senate Bill 967 is there any requirement that the utility must actually pay the income taxes that it charges to ratepayers. Instead, that requirement is repealed. The appropriate response to the legislature, do I consider the inaccurate implementation of Senate Bill 408 by the PUC, is not to repeal the law, but is to simplify the PUC's implementation of it by specifying in law adoption of what we call the Pennsylvania methodology for attributing some part of the income taxes that are paid by a parent corporation to its subsidiary utility in a way that is both transparent and can be checked against the income tax filings of both the parent and the subsidiary, if there are any income tax filings by the subsidiary. House Bill 3462 does that and should be adopted instead of Senate Bill 967. Let's not turn back the clock and once again allow the PUC to do what it has wanted to do all along, which is allow utilities to charge ratepayers for income taxes that the utilities actually do not pay.
Okay. Thank you very much. Questions for Mr. Meek or comments?
Oh, and I've attached to the testimony a recent article by David K. Johnston addressing specifically this bill in a publication called State Tax Notes. He's a Pulitzer Prize-winning former tax reporter for the New York Times, and also the text of the op-ed piece written by Senators Metzger and Walker in 2005.
Okay, thank you. Any further questions or comments? See none. Those are all entered into the record. Is there anyone else wishing to speak on Senate Bill 967? See none.
Oh, Mr. Chair, apologize. Member Seff, you do have in front of you written testimony in support of the measure from IBEW Local 125.
Thank you very much. Let the record so note. Is there any further question or comment regarding the bill? See none. We'll close the hearing on Senate Bill 967. Is there an interest in moving this bill forward?
I would like to, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Let's open a work session on Senate Bill 967.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 967 forward to pass recommendation.
Okay. Chair Schaffler moves Senate Bill 967 to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Seeing none. Is there any objection? Seeing none, it is unanimous.
I believe Representative Esquivel here would like to carry this bill on the floor.
He sent me a note to that effect. Representative, would you like to carry this bill?
Be happy to.
Okay. Representative Esquivel will carry this
bill. I will prepare my questions in advance.
I appreciate that.
And I'll look forward to proofreading those.
But remember, we don't have to submit to the questions.
Thank you.
There's no time clock on the answer. That's the beauty of answering.
Okay, gentlemen.
Forgive me, Mr. Chair.
No forgiveness today. We're going to proceed with the agenda as the agenda reads, sort of. And the reason for that is Senator Devlin has a very tight schedule, and we will try to accommodate him on Senate Bill 935 at his convenience. So, that being the case, we're ready to open a hearing on Senate Bill 153.
Mr. Chair, Committee Member, Senate Bill 153 allows the Construction Contractors Board to adopt rules to determine whether an inspection and report that is limited to one or more specific systems or components of a residential structure is a sufficient assessment to constitute a home inspection requiring the services of a certified home inspector. The measure passed unanimously out of the Senate Business, Transportation, and Economic Development Committee and the Senate floor. There's no revenue or fiscal impact on the measure.
Okay. Okay, and we'll begin testimony. Signed up is Craig Smith. Welcome. Please give us your name and let's proceed.
Chair Kenmore, members of the committee, Craig Smith, Construction Contractors Board. This is a small clarification bill having to do with the certification of home inspectors. That law was passed about 15 years ago. It's been a fine law. This is the folks that do those inspections when you buy a home. But the law is fairly broad, and what this amendment would do, this bill, is it would allow the agency to write rules to exclude some folks that do energy audits, for example, folks that do FHA inspections, for example. We believe we have the authority to do that now, but we want to make sure that that's what the legislature wants us to do. I know of no opposition to the bill, and if you have no other questions, I'll rest with that.
I don't know. Let's see if we have any questions for Mr. Smith or comments. Representative Matthews.
Just to further clarify, what we're trying to do here is if somebody were to inspect an HVAC system, they wouldn't need to be required as a home inspector. They could just simply inspect the HVAC itself without, and that would just be set by rule by your agency.
Chair Kenmore and Representative Matthews, that'd be correct.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative Esquivel.
I think it's very important that we understand what a home inspector does when you purchase a home. They go actually from the top of the roof clear down to the foundation itself. They go under, do understructure, check for infestation of bugs, and literally go through the whole house, actually. So what they're doing is, what I'm seeing here is we're taking specific parts of this that would be part of a home inspection, but only to a certain specific target area that should not be licensed.
Do you want to comment on that, please, Mr. Smith?
Chair Kenmore and Representative Esquivel, that's correct. I think that there are some specialty investigations or specialty inspections that are being done. They involve more than one or two aspects of the house, but not the overall condition of the house. We want to make it clear that those folks don't need a home inspection certification.
Okay. Chair Schaffler.
Thank you. I support what you're doing here, Craig. I support the bill. And I used to think that going with rule was the best way to go, but that has blown up in my face so many times. What I don't want to see is this back here again with problems with it. So make rules that can be enforced and are easily understood and complied with. Thank you.
Hey, Representative Doherty.
Sir, is this a correct assumption that, for example, if I need to have something inspected in my home but not the entire house, that it would be cheaper for me and the consumer to be able to get specialty inspectors as opposed to have an entire home inspection?
Chair Kenmore, Representative Doherty, I don't think that it necessarily would be cheaper. I mean, in some cases, these types of inspections could be free, particularly if you were having just a roof installed or perhaps getting an inspection for an energy audit, perhaps. But other cases, like the building exterior shell folks that are engineers that do a look on the outside of the structure, they may charge for that. They might even charge more than a common home inspection. But they wouldn't necessarily have to have the regulation imposed by home inspection law.
Thank you very much.
Okay. Any further questions? Thank you, Mr. Smith. Appreciate it. Anyone else wishing to testify on Senate Bill 153? Seeing none, we'll close the hearing on Senate Bill 153. Is there an interest in proceeding? Sure. Apparently we're in order. Let's open the work session on Senate Bill 153.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 153 to pass recommendation.
Okay. Chair Schaffler moves Senate Bill 153 to the floor with due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion?
Good bill should pass.
Good bill should pass. Okay, any further discussion? Seeing none. Is there any objection? Seeing none, it is unanimous. So ordered.
Mr. Chair, this looks like something that would merit the consent calendar.
Mm-hmm. I think
unless there's objection.
I just wonder if it isn't a tweak that's kind of important. That would be my view, is I think we probably ought to have a carrier.
I think Representative Esquivel brought up a good point about how valuable home inspections are, and if somebody were to misinterpret what we're doing here to eliminate the home inspection, they might be confused by what we're doing. We might want a brief explanation.
And I also think Representative Schaffler's point about
Representative
we have concerns about rules, and we'd like to maybe send better.
Sure.
Representative Matthews, you wish to carry or I'll carry?
I'd be happy to carry it for you.
Representative
Chair,
Matthews absolutely will carry the bill.
With help from Co-Chair Schaffler, I'm sure.
There we go. Okay. We're ready to go to our next hearing. We'll open a hearing on Senate Bill 155.
Mr. Chair, committee members, Senate Bill 155 modifies the definitions of residential structure and small commercial structure for purposes of construction contractor laws by adding the term appurtenance to both definitions. The measure will pass out unanimously of the Senate Business and Transportation Economic Development Committee and off the Senate floor with a 22-7 vote. You have in front of you a -2 amendment which requires the Construction Contractors Board to adopt criteria allowing for the exemption of residential contractors from board rules requiring continuing education and state building code compliance requiring building exterior shell training. There is no revenue on the amendment. We do not have the official analysis from Legislative Fiscal, but we do have what the Construction Contractors Board turned in, and there is no fiscal on that amendment.
Okay. And it looks like we have Craig Smith and Scott Berry signed up. Please, Mr. Smith.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Craig Smith, Construction Contractors Board. This, again, is a fairly simple bill at the beginning. It has to do with the law that was passed in 2007 separating commercial and residential contractors. That's been a law, as some of you know, has been being implemented over the last 3 years. It's provided some consternation between our regulation and the folks that we regulate. We're trying to help with that. And one of this, what this bill does is it provides a definition and adds the word appurtenance to those types of structures. So it's very clear that when a residential contractor is working on a small structure adjacent to a residence or adjacent to a small commercial structure, that residential license can be used. That's what the bill in chief does. Can I answer any questions?
Any questions?
Could you give me an example of what in practicality, what this would be? Actually, I got my house, and then I've got somebody coming in. Can you give me an example of what structure would be?
What? Sure. Representative Kinnemer and Representative Doherty. An appurtenance would be like a fence, a swimming pool, an outbuilding. Those are the types of things that we're trying to define.
Further question? Any further?
I just wanted to say thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate Rep. Doherty's question. I've pulled a lot of building permits in my time, but I don't think I've ever pulled one for an appurtenance or however you say it. Okay. Houses, garages, you know, that stuff's fine, but it's a nomenclature we're not familiar with.
Any further questions or comments? Thank you very much. Mr. Berry?
Good morning, members of the committee. Scott Berry on behalf of the Oregon Home Builders Association. And we, in concert with the Construction Contractors Board, are responsible for the Dash 2s to Senate Bill 155. The reason for the Dash 2s coming forward is we have seen this session after the requirement of continuing ed for all residential contractors. Yeah. We have seen a number of bills come forward exempting particular individuals, particular contractors, from the education requirements of the building code and of the building exterior shell training. And our interest was in trying to provide an amendment that would allow the contractors board to address that so that the further legislation exempting individual types of contractors that don't work on the structure of the house or that don't work with the building code but might do decorative metalwork or other things like that, some concrete work that's again outside the house, doesn't have anything to do with the actual shell training or the building code, could be exempt from those particular parts of the required training. In addition, it also allows the Construction Contractors Board to develop a list of approved providers of continuing education, so that I think our contractors at that point would have some confidence that they're getting education from someone who has the ability to provide good quality continuing education.
Okay. Questions?
I just think I am a licensed contractor in the state of Oregon, and I believe I need to declare conflict. I may have to declare a conflict of interest, so that's what I'm doing right now. And then, if I may, my question, Craig, is
just a second. Let me just note that you have declared a potential conflict of interest for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Chair Schaffler, and you wish to continue,
yeah,
please.
Craig, does I don't know if you're familiar with my license, but do I fall underneath this? I just renewed it over there. You were there. I went and talked to some of you folks, but do I fall underneath this?
Chair Kenemer and Representative Schaffler, you do fall under the requirement to have continuing education.
All righty then. Good.
No cigar.
Well, it's a large group, so he may be excluded from having to declare conflict of interest, but I think it's always safe to do
it. Yes, sir. All right, thank you.
Okay. Anyone else wishing to discuss or question? Yes, Representative Johnson, please.
Chair, I need to also declare potential conflict, as I am also a licensed general contractor. However, not the same type that I think my brother down the row here is. I'm a general. You're probably a specialty. Is that correct?
I got to go back up and look at it. I was a general, but I think I turned. I can't remember exactly what I am now.
Can we discuss that in the committee?
That stuff not to get going on, Mr. Chair. Thank you,
Mr. Chair.
That's great.
I'm just.
Do you have anything else you wish to say before you drink your coffee?
I'm just a legislator.
Representative Johnson, just a minute. And you've noted a potential conflict of interest for the record, and wish to continue.
Scott, the Dash 2s came out after the floor vote on the Senate, is that correct?
Co-chairs and Representative Johnson, that's correct.
Would that have helped the vote on the floor? I noticed there were 7 nays over there.
Co-chairs and Representative Johnson, I'm not aware that that would necessarily help the bill at all. I did testify on Senate Bill 155 in the Senate, and there was some concern, I think, about some of the changes that were made in 155, but frankly, I believe that they were related to the original bill, 3242, which passed, which was controversial. And this is clarifying that bill, but I think it did bring up some memories of folks who had testified and were involved in the passing of that original bill.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Chair
Just Stoffel. To clarify for the record, my license is inactive. I just keep it up to date, because you never know when you got to go back to do some real work, and as long as I own a shovel, I'll never starve to death. But just in case anybody's watching this show, I am a licensed contractor in the state of Oregon, but my license is inactive, and I haven't done any commercial or residential contracting since 2004. So there you go.
There we go. Thank you. Any further questions or comments? See none. Thank you, gentlemen. Is there anyone else wishing to speak on Senate Bill 155? Seeing none, we'll close the hearing on Senate Bill 155.
Dash 2s, Mr. Chair.
Let's open a work session on Senate Bill 155.
You have to do it with a rule suspension.
Mr. Chair, I move we spend rules for the purpose of adopting the Dash 2 amendments and without the fiscal.
Okay. Chair Schaffler moves that we suspend the rules for purposes of adopting the Dash 2 amendments without the fiscal. Is there any discussion?
Yes, question. Representative
so,
Doherty.
Is the fiscal, do we have some sort of an idea of what the fiscal, just
Thank
not
you.
Official?
Yes. Good point.
Mr. Chair, Vice Chair Doherty, yes. The Construction Contractors Board did forward to me the form, their fiscal form that they turned into the Legislative Fiscal Office, and there is no fiscal impact.
Thank you.
At least that's our anticipation, and if not, I'm sure we'll be hearing from the co-speakers.
Yes. Mr. Chair, actually, it's a good point to point out. If there is a change to it, what we would do is we would have another work it would be considered as another work session, so there would be a rule suspension to reconsider the vote and then re-vote on the bill.
Okay, thank you.
I think as a general procedure, we've been talking about as a committee to work as expeditiously as we reasonably can. These bills have been previously vetted. On the other hand, we're under no huge time constraint at the moment. So if there's anyone has a problem with the bill, they should discuss it with us.
I feel very confident with that answer.
And, Mr. Chair, if I'd remind everyone, this is just a motion to suspend the rules. We're going to have another motion on the merits or demerits of the...
That's true. Thank you, and that's a good correction as well. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Okay, we have before us a motion. Is there any further discussion? Seeing none. Is there any objection? Seeing none, so ordered.
Mr. Chair, I move Dash 2 amendments in the Senate Bill 155.
Just a minute. We moved the Dash 2 amendment.
No, we just did
we just suspended.
Excuse me. Thank you. Okay. Chair Schaffler moves the Dash 2 amendments into Senate Bill 155. Is there any discussion? Seeing none. Is there any objection? Seeing none, so ordered.
Teresa, do we need rule suspension to move the bill to the floor?
I think, Mr. Chair, Chair Schaffler, I think we're okay.
All right. I move, Mr. Chair, if I may, I move Senate Bill 155 as amended floor to pass recommendation.
Okay. Chair Schaffler moves Senate Bill 155 as amended to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Seeing none. Is there any objection? Seeing none, it is unanimous. So ordered.
Chair, I'd like to carry this bill on the floor so I can further clarify my status as a contractor in the great state of Oregon.
Mr. Chair, I recommend coffee instead, but I'd be happy to accommodate.
And I won't submit questions to you ahead of time.
I do. I can count on you, Representative.
Mr. Chair, I think one of our members was missing on a previous vote. Would you like to ask for something?
Yes, sir. Mr. Chair, I move we suspend the rules for the purposes of allowing Representative Hoyle to vote on Senate Bill 967.
Okay. Chair Schaffler moves that we suspend the rules so that Representative Hoyle can vote on Senate Bill 967. Is there any objection or any discussion? Seeing none. Without objection, so ordered. Representative Hoyle?
I vote aye.
Aye. Please let the record note that she votes aye. Okay. Let's see. I think we're... I think what we'll do now, we're waiting still for Representative Senator Devlin, is we'll move to our informational hearing on House Bill 2355. Yeah. Do you want to add anything, or should
no.
we just... Okay. This is an informational hearing. Let's start out. We have two panels. Don Des Brisset, excuse me for botching that. Lon Holston and Tom Chamberlain, please.
Good morning, Co-Chair Kenemer. Co-Chair Schaffler, and committee members. My name is Dawn Debrisset. I'm a longshore worker and president of the International Longshore and Warehouse Union, Local Number 40. I and 1,000 of my fellow longshore workers in Oregon load and unload the ships that export America's grain, agricultural products, and manufactured goods, and import electronics, apparel, wind energy components. My international union's officers at the Coast Longshore Division in San Francisco have supported me in the past year as I have worked to promote short-term disability insurance in Oregon, and they would like to thank you for hearing my testimony and that of the fellow speakers today. My personal story demonstrates how short-term disability can strike any of us when we least expect it.
bear in mind that there are tens of thousands of people like me and have brought some personal stories with me today in written testimony. One person I'd like to mention is Marianne Montler of Portland, a professional single mother who suffered a heart attack in her early 30s. Marianne's treatment included open-heart surgery and a recovery period, which she lost her income, her savings, and her house. Thankfully, Marianne has regained her health, but sadly, Oregon has lost a talented and highly skilled young worker. Due to high unemployment in Oregon last year, Marianne's job search ended in Chicago, where she's working as an analyst for the federal government. Marianne asked me to tell her story today because she has learned the hard way that short-term disability can lead even the most responsible people to financial devastation, and she does not want other Oregonians to have the rug pulled out from under them in the future. Like Marianne, I have always been healthy and active and have always taken good care of myself. I'm not a smoker. So it came as a total shock 3 years ago when I was diagnosed with breast cancer. I couldn't believe it was happening to me. And I'm sure none of the other 21,000 Oregonians who were diagnosed with cancer in 2010 could believe it was happening to them. My course of treatment included a lumpectomy, 30 rounds of radiation, followed by 5 years of drug therapy. It was a harrowing experience, but I'll tell you what haunted me the most. Though I have my union's health care plan and short-term disability, most of the other women I saw in treatment were not so lucky. Without short-term disability insurance to cover a portion of their income, these women were forced to shuffle into work every day, completely spent and worn out from their cancer treatment. No doubt this shortchanged their own recovery as well as impacted their performance at work. I realized something had to be done. Somehow Oregon must develop a common sense, responsible solution that allows working Oregonians to recover from illnesses and return to work healthy and productive. This is good for workers, their families, and employers who stand to gain a healthy and productive employee, and local and state governments, which will see fewer people come to rely on public services. Fortunately, several other states have decades of proven track records of administering short-term disability programs, and I know Oregon can do at least as well as states like Hawaii, Rhode Island, and California. With my international union support, I have worked for the past year to draft and redraft a state disability insurance bill and convene interested parties to bring House Bill 2355 to the state capitol. Along the way, I heard dozens of stories from people who have fallen off ladders, been diagnosed with cancer, tripped over a dog, or for some other reason found themselves with a completely unexpected disability and sudden loss of income. I talked with members of the Oregon AFL-CIO Executive Board who voted to make House Bill 2355 one of the Oregon AFL-CIO's top three legislative priorities for 2011. The Working Families Party also endorsed House Bill 2355, and they are here today to tell you the many important reasons why. A few highlights before I wrap up my testimony. House Bill 23 and the similar bill that we will introduce in the next session does not tax the employer. It is entirely self-funded through minimal payroll tax financed 100% by employees. It provides a partial wage replacement to eligible workers who suffer a loss of income when they are unable to work due to a non-work-related illness or injury or a medically disabling condition from pregnancy or childbirth. The program can be administered by the Employment Department, consistently with Oregon's existing unemployment insurance system, using many of the same formulas and systems that already exist. The program will be available to every employee in Oregon. To participate, a worker has to have paid into the State Disability Insurance Fund for at least 18 months. Individuals who have paid into the fund for more than 6 months, but fewer than 18 months, will be eligible to receive a reduced benefit for a reduced period of time. Employers can opt out of the program if they provide superior benefits through an insurance carrier or a self-insured plan. To qualify, the employer-provided alternative must be approved by the Oregon Employment Department and have the consent of the majority of the employees and provide superior benefits to those available through the state program without costing the employees more money. Though House Bill 2355 didn't get a public hearing this session, I am very proud of this bill and would like to tell you about it because we're in this for the long haul. Oregon needs a state disability insurance program. Between now and the next session, we will be working hard to craft a bill that will be worthy of support from business and labor. We welcome your feedback and look forward to working with you for years to come. Thank you.
Thank you. Who's next, please?
My name is Lon Holston. I represent Laborers International Union in North America, and I've represented public and private workers for approximately 35 years, if not longer. In 2001, I became injured. I became one of the folks that was injured at home and had an extended recovery time. What I soon learned with my private employer at the time was that the health insurance benefits were great. They took care of one particular problem that I had. The other problem was is that I didn't have any income. My wife went out, got herself a job, then got a second job to try to make ends meet. This not only affected my credit rating because it still wasn't enough money to replace my income, and the situation slowly eroded. After I almost lost my life and was able to come back and go back to work, I spent 7 years living as a transient, moving from one house to another because I was forced to sell my original house that I just finished remodeling and building. That was problematic for me because I had my heart and soul in that house, and then to move 7 times in 5 years was some more expenses, and trying to recover my credit rating was problematic. I can tell you that in my job, I represent a lot of folks who get injured off the job. You're covered on the job with workers' compensation, but a lot of the folks I represent, after they're injured, have a stroke or a major illness, need some help getting themselves to where they need to be. Now, some employers have long-term disability. Some employers have short-term disability. Those are great bridging mechanisms that get them healthy and back to work. However, if you have no short-term disability, you're left with no income, whether you're in the private or the public sector. And what I've found is I had one particular member who had a stroke. The employer called me and said, "Do you know where this guy is at?" I said, "I don't know, but let's look." We found him in the parking lot of the employer. He was living in his car. He'd had 5 strokes, didn't know what to do or where to go. Now, you'd say it'd be real simple and easy to be able to get this guy what he needed, but after months of trying to find a way to get this guy some short-term disability, he didn't have the ability. So we had to wait the 60-day waiting period just to get him his long-term disability, then try to move him into PERS disability. What we soon learned, and the employer learned, was with no safety net, this guy would have had some severe problems being homeless and everything else. So the short side of this, representatives, was the employer, who was good enough to keep this person working in a light-duty status until we could get some safety nets under him, was critical for him to not stay homeless and to get him back with a life manager and get him taken care of. These aren't isolated cases. I deal with this on a daily basis, and you would think, well, we have PERS disability and that's a great thing and we can get them. There's timelines that destroys that premise. These folks are homeless before they ever achieve those and complete those timelines. And then you want to talk about paperwork. You have extended paperwork you need to fill out. You've got doctor visits. You have to keep going back for whatever entity is out there, whether it's private insurance, PERS, or Social Security. If you're trying to get to a vehicle of getting them disability, if they're permanently disabled, it's 18 months for Social Security. These people are long homeless, and you lose them at that point. We need some kind of bridging for Oregonians, hardworking Oregonians, who don't want anybody meddling in their business. They don't want handouts. All they want to do is get better and go back to work. The problem here, folks, is we don't have the short term that gets them into the long-term disability insurance that they really need today. We've taken as a society a stance to say, let's take care of hardworking Oregonians, and we've done so with workers' compensation. We've done so in some areas with long-term disability, and we've done so with Social Security and PERS disability, but that's not enough. We've got to get them to those end games, and the only way to do that is to have some bridging. So with that, I'm willing to answer any questions the committee may have.
Any questions or comments?
Okay, yeah.
Thank you, Tom.
Chair Kenemer, Chair Schaffler, members of the committee. My name's Tom Chamberlain. I'm president of the Oregon AFL-CIO, representing 225,000 working families here in Oregon. One-third of all Americans will become disabled for 90 days or more between the ages of 35 and 65. Five states already have short-term disability programs that cover approximately 60% of wage replacement between 26 and 52 weeks. Most are funded through a payroll tax. We understand that it'll take some work to figure out the best way to fund a distinctively Oregon program with the right level of wage replacement and the duration of assistance for our state's program. We look forward to working with you in the interim until the next legislative session. Thank you.
Yes, Chair.
Thank you. Chair Schaffler.
It's always nice to see my brothers and sisters in the room fighting for working men and women and families in this state, and I appreciate what you're trying to do here. And I got to say, I've been blessed having been a laborer of one form or another and a proud member of the Laborers Union for 8 years, but for 30 years of labor, knock on wood, I never experienced anything like that. But that being said, I've put my own roof on. I've done all kinds of things that with one wrong step could have led to devastating injuries that could have bankrupted me. My wife and I are blessed with, we're insured to the teeth. But that being said, if we weren't, we are one illness or injury away from bankruptcy and homelessness, as Lan so aptly pointed out, and even shared his own experience. I definitely see the need for what you're doing. I think what I would like to see is the math done showing how this community will save money, because it's about the money. Mm-hmm. And if anybody says it's not about being a human being or humanity or being nice, this is about money and people being able to bridge that gap and stay in their house. I think you could make a mathematical equation and formula and explanation showing how this will save this community money and insurance providers and healthcare providers money. I really believe you can do that, to say nothing of the pain and suffering a family or a worker can go through if they lack this. There's one more request I want I want to see some businesses coming up supporting this. Actually, I think the business community would be well served in sitting down and talking to you, because I think it'll save them money, get a good worker back to work. A good crew, a good member of your crew is a valuable asset. I know that for sure. But there's one more thing I want to say. I think it's important. This political climate, not just here in this building or up here in the dais, but out there in that world, is not ready for one more tax. And that we got the tax to pay for the bridge in Clackamas County. We're going to have a toll for I-5. We have Clackamas Community College. I'm just talking about Mott, where I live. We read about Portland, all these school districts need more money. I don't even think the workers who would benefit from this would come here, if they all could come here right now and say, I want that one more deduction out of my paycheck to take care of myself. Now, if they experienced what Long went through, they'd understand. But guess what? You don't put in the arms at the railroad crossing until a bunch of people are run over by a train. That's how it works in this country, unfortunately. So I've shared with you what I'd like to see, what I think would benefit your cause, but I really appreciate you, what you're doing here today, and thanks for coming. Thank you for indulging me, Mr.
Chairman. Thank you.
Any Representative Doherty?
Again, as a comment, maybe you're also a request. I've been lucky because I've been a union member since I was 19, and we've had long-term disability but not short-term, and working out of the public sector, I've had accumulated sick leave, and since I'm never sick, I would be able to avail myself of sick leave. But after working with public employees for 30 years, we found out that even with the sick leave wasn't long enough, and we had long-term disability. But to go through, and if any of you ever have to go through and go through the labyrinth of trying to get disability, it is awful. And not only is there the waiting period, but that's the waiting period after you've gone through and been able to do the paperwork, which is horrible. And the one thing that I noticed in the last couple of years before I retired was how many more 30-plus people we were getting on disability because of cancer treatments. And it was something that it used to be the 50 and 60-somethings, but it was getting younger and younger, and these were people with young kids. So I think this is a very, very good idea. I think one thing that might be helpful is just to begin the education process, I think, first of all, this is coming out of the employees, which I think is a good thing, of letting people know how much this costs, because it varies. Long-term disability, short-term disability varies month to month, and it varies with different programs, and so I think that would be something that would be helpful. But we've had lots of people that, and especially younger ones, that have had to avail themselves of long-term disability, and they forget that sometimes you have to have a 90-day waiting period, then it's two-thirds of your, it's not your entire salary. Mm-hmm. And so those are the sort of things that people hopefully will never have to use, but it's something that's very important. But I think that bridge, if you don't have an employer that you can use accumulated sick leave when you're out, it's something that's absolutely critical. So thank you.
I want to thank you for coming too, and I think I know this experience personally. Back quite a while ago, my first wife was diagnosed with breast cancer that had metastasized the spine, and I remember the enormous hardship it created for our family. And ultimately, at that time, I was in the state senate. And one day, I came home, and Sharon's illness was progressing, and she said, you know, you need to get a real job. And I had to leave the legislature because I couldn't afford to work for the pittance that we made in those days. I also remember the hurdles of long-term disability. I can't remember whether before she passed away we received one or were scheduled to receive the first Social Security disability benefit, because really it's almost a minimum of a three-year process. Two, supposedly, but it really takes at least three. And then it's complicated because if you have any work in the meantime and all kinds of things. So it's a huge need. I understand where you're coming from. Thank you.
Thank you.
Oh, excuse me, Representative Matthews.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. And I just want to thank Don. Thanks for your story and sharing your strength, and appreciate that, and wish you the best of luck.
Thank you.
Having been through that with family, I know that the years keep going by, but you're always looking back and worried about what might be coming at the next appointment. So keep up the great work.
Thank you.
And I also want to say, for the record, the one thing we haven't talked about is not only the injury itself, but also the mentality that comes with that injury, and the doubt in your ability to return to work, and what's going to happen to your family, and how that takes. I mean, it is an emotional, psychological strain. I'm a firefighter. I had a knee reconstruction surgery. I was out for 11 months on the job injury, coming off the ladder, third apartment fire on the 4th of July, third story apartment. Terrible. And I just remember going through what I went through is this going to heal? Am I going to get back to work? Will I be able to do the job that I love? Will I be able to provide for the family? So I certainly get what you're doing. I applaud your efforts. And to my brother Tom there, if you want to keep me posted in the interim as to how this is going, or perhaps there's some meetings that we might be able to attend, I'd sure be interested in keeping up with you and finding out where we're going. I think Co-Chair Schaffler brought up a great point about business, where they're going to need to be included, obviously, to try to get this thing moving forward. But today is a good first step to get this out there in the public and start talking about it. So thank you very much for bringing it out.
Thank you very much. We're going to, as I mentioned earlier, we have Senator Devlin arriving. We're going to interrupt this informational hearing for a few brief moments and hear from Senator Devlin. With that, we'll take a recess on the informational hearing. And we'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 935. Senator Devlin, nice to have you with us. We're interrupting another process. If you can make this short and sweet, we would appreciate it.
Okay. Thank you, Chairman Kenemer and Chairman Schaffler. I will make this brief. Senate Bill 935 comes to you from the Senate with a unanimous vote, 30-0, on the Senate floor, and a unanimous vote out of committee. I'm hoping to
Senator
actually...
Senator Devlin, I think, need you to give us your name, too.
Oh, okay.
Excuse me.
I do this on the other side all the time.
Well, we all botch it, period. It's pretty funny. Please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Richard Devlin, Senate District 19. As I stated earlier, this comes from a unanimous vote on the Senate floor and a unanimous vote in the Senate Committee on Business, Transportation, and Economic Development. I'm not presuming what the support level will be for this in the House, but I would tell you that I've had very few bills that have had as little resistance. When we talk about bills in this building, They come through the building every session in different ways. There are big bills, which have been developed with the assistance and support of numerous stakeholders after months, if not years, of discussion, debate, and compromise. There are medium bills where members have approached very complex issues and spent many hours to try to sell a concept. And there are small bills which can make a big difference in a few Oregonians' lives. My friends, this is a small bill and can help some people of Oregon get back on their feet and recover from the effects of the worst economic climate we've seen since the Great Depression. If we pass SB 935, we'll be able to help some Oregonians remain employed or restart their businesses and continue to be contributing members of our economy. The idea for this bill came to me from a constituent. Her and her husband faced a personal bankruptcy and basically had to sell off all the equipment for their business and were not able to restart their business even with a small bit of tools that they might have needed to do that. They approached me after learning that numerous other states allow debtors to retain more of the tools of their equipment. As many of you know, bankruptcy is governed by federal law. Federal law, however, provides each state with the opportunity to determine the type and value of property that may be exempted. Oregon has taken advantage of this opportunity and established its own exemption amounts. SB 935 specifically updates the tools of the trade exemption by raising the amount from $3,000 to $5,000. Both the bill and the bill's relating clause are limited to the tools of the trade exemption. Oregon has not updated this exemption for almost 20 years. The last increase was in 1993. Further, our neighbors to the north, Washington, our neighbor to the south, California, both allow higher levels of exemption than Oregon does. As we all know, in this economy, there have been a lot of casualties. Last year alone in Oregon, over 20,000 Oregonians filed for personal bankruptcy. Many that have lost their jobs have worked in skilled trades where they are expected to have the tools of their trade, whether they're involved in construction or an auto mechanic or numerous other positions. It doesn't really matter if you're a contractor in Bend or a small business owner in Lake Oswego. Restarting a business takes more than commitment, strength of character. It often takes tools and equipment. This particular bill is a small update to existing law which could make life better for a few Oregonians struggling to restart their businesses or to return to the workforce. For those that might be concerned about if there's any opposition to this bill, I have had discussions with representatives for banks, credit unions, finance companies, debt collectors. No one opposes the bill. They all realize, as we do, that the best thing that could happen in this state is for more people to return to productive employment. I hope that you will pass SB 935 and reaffirm our commitment to Oregon's people and its economy, and I ask for your support.
Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Chair Schaffer.
Briefly, and I'm sure my colleague at the end of the dais could probably even have more. If I had to replace every tool I have in my garage, I have hundreds of them. It would probably be $20,000, and $5,000 ain't very many tools. So, but I appreciate the bill, and I'll keep it short, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Representative Esquivel.
Yes, on these insurance policies, I lost $4,400 worth of tools, but they replaced everything.
Yeah.
Is it just the kind of policy you get, or what?
No, this is in the. Mr. Chairman, Representative Esquivel, this is in the case of where someone is facing bankruptcy, what they're able to retain. And so this would allow someone to retain, instead of $3,000 worth of the personal tools of their profession, occupation, it would be $5,000 that they would be able to retain. And I think as Co-Chair Schaffler has indicated, $5,000 for a lot of people is a relatively modest amount. But at least is a little bit more and at least a little bit better possibility that they might be able to continue to be employed. I don't know if you've received it. My staff is in the background, but we have sent to other committees a letter from a contractor in Bend that has talked about the number of tradespeople that work for him and the number of people that have been in personal difficulty, as you may well know. Bend and Deschutes County is perhaps one of the worst areas in the state in terms of the impact of this recession. And he's talked about many people there that have worked for him having difficulty returning to work because of losing everything.
Follow-up for a
question. Yes. I'm sorry, I misread the bill. I see that now. But my other question is, I used to do bankruptcies for the trustee.
Yes.
And I'm going to have to ask some of the contractors here because they never got into that kind of stuff. They just took the solid assets like house, things of this nature, anything that was property. But I never did see them get into the inventory, I guess you'd say. Is that pretty common?
Yes. Mr. Chairman, Representative Esquivel, these are just simply the exemptions, the things that they would not take away from a person, so that they would be allowed to, under current law, to exempt up to $3,000 in value of tools, and under this, up to $5,000. And this can't, as the law is written, this can't be a hobby or anything like this. This is the actual underlying occupation that the individual has and the necessity of having those tools to continue in the occupation.
Further question, Representative.
Yes. I have an attorney with me here who actually understands this better than
I do. The reason I'm asking this, because when I did bankruptcies, when I would take the properties and put them on the market for the trustee, the one thing I found out is the bankruptcy court made up all the rules. Mm-hmm. And federal law governed the bankruptcies, not state law.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Esquivel, in Oregon is one of the states. It's governed by federal law. The federal government allows you to actually put in place your own exemptions, which Oregon has done. And in this particular case, the exemption currently is $3,000, and this bill would merely raise it to $5,000.
Thank you. Thank you. Any further questions?
Representative Johnson.
Senator, do you have any idea when the last time was that these dollar figures in this statute were updated?
Yes. Okay. Mr. Please. Chairman, Representative Johnson, the last time was 1993.
Thank you.
Okay. Any further questions? Thank you very much, Senator.
Thank you.
We're going to take a recess on Senate Bill 935. We'll come back to it. We'll finish up, and we appreciate the courtesy with the other folks on the House bill. So we'll recess this momentarily, and we'll reopen our informational hearing on 2355. And we have two more people, Barbara Dudley and Andrea Peluso.
Please.
Please give us your name and let's proceed.
My name is Barbara Dudley. I'm co-chair of the Working Families Party. Thank you, Chair Kinnemer and Chair Schaffler and committee members for having this informational hearing. As you all yourselves were saying just a few minutes ago, the need for short-term disability insurance is obvious. It's a very high priority for the Working Families Party because too many working Oregonians live with the fear that they will become ill or will be injured in an accident and will be unable to work and earn the wages necessary to take care of their families. As many of you said, we have all known people or ourselves undergone medical treatments that kept us from our jobs. But only the lucky ones are covered by union contracts or by employer programs which provide disability coverage. We cannot in this state have a workplace where only the lucky are covered by insurance. That is what this is all about. Because the number of people covered by union contracts is shrinking, the number of employers who are voluntarily providing this kind of insurance is shrinking. And so I agree entirely that we need to have employers at the table, and I think that reasonable employers like reasonable workers will understand that if we share the costs of this, it will be much cheaper for everybody and the benefits will accrue to all. Because an employer also finds his workplace totally quite dysfunctional. When workers are off the job and can't come back to work for a number of months because of some kind of medical treatment, they don't want to lose that experienced worker. This does not involve an employer tax. It seeks to cover all workers through a shared minimal payroll tax. It is far better than dealing locality by locality with this kind of an issue. Basically, I don't want to take too much of your time because I think you know most of the details, but just to say one thing, this program fills a need that no existing program fills. Workers' comp does not cover workers who are injured or ill other than on-the-job injuries. And workers' comp during appeals is not available to the worker. So you can have a family fall into homelessness and dysfunction very quickly simply because there are no wages coming in. And this program would basically cover in the interim while a workers' comp claim is being appealed, and would then, the workers' comp claim, if it is accepted later on, would compensate this program for the payments it made. So I want you to take very seriously the need for this program as we talk about jobs in this legislature. We need to realize that there's more than just providing a job. It's also providing a good job and a decent workplace and the possibility for workers to remain employed despite the vagaries of illness and accident. So I urge you to consider this as part of a suite of different programs that need to be talked about in the future for how Oregon is going to come into the 21st century, basically, accept the fact that unions are no longer covering the majority of our workers, and realize that we need to come up with programs that will provide this kind of safety net. Thank you.
Thank you. Please continue.
Hello. I'm Chair Schaffler, Chair Kenemer, members of the committee. My name is Andrea Peluso. I'm the Executive Director of Family Forward Oregon, which is a nonprofit working to create workplace and public policies that work for families. And we are supporters of this concept, House Bill 2355, because we believe that statewide access to short-term disability insurance helps families in Oregon to deal with economic stressors associated with illness. You've heard from others and you've expressed your own experiences with a need for this kind of program. And I'd like to speak a little bit more about what's going on in other parts of the country with regards to this. I did include in my testimony a little chart that kind of gives you some information, basic information about what exists in the five other states that have short-term disability insurance, California, Hawaii, New Jersey, New York, and Rhode Island. Basically, in most of those states, the program is employee paid, and there is a difference in sort of what amount folks get paid out to and what the caps are. So I wanted you to have that information, and I included also some links to some additional information about those. I'd like to speak a little bit to, you've heard about the need for employees to have access to this kind of benefit, and I think it also helps our state's employers to have access to this kind of program. Currently, I think we put a lot of burden on employers to be the primary route of access to things like health insurance and short-term disability insurance. And what creating a statewide program does is simplifies and creates a uniform system that employers can access that's uniformly expressed throughout the state and simplifies their administrative burdens with regards to this. And it also insures all employees, which I think saves the state money in terms of their access to other programs, but also helps employers whose employees are taking time off to get better and not going in and out of the workforce and causing them additional needs for time off, but really taking the time off that they need to get better and then return to the workforce when they're ready to work. So I would urge you to please let us know if you have any suggestions for how to move this forward. We definitely do plan to come back with this concept in future sessions and think this is a critically important program to the working families of the state, to the employers of the state, and to the state's budget in the long term. Thanks.
Thank you. Any questions or comments? Seeing none, thank you very much. And I guess I would echo Chair Schaffler's comments. I think the parties missing at today's table would be the employers. Mm-hmm. And I would encourage you to work with them. Thank you very much. With that, we have concluded our informational hearing on House Bill 2355. And with that, we will resume our hearing then on Senate Bill 935. We have at least two more people who have asked to speak or testify, Eric Olson and Chris Mertens, please. Please give us your name and let's proceed.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Eric Olson. I'm a senior partner of Olson Daines. We're the largest law firm in Oregon that practices consumer bankruptcy. Two offices in Portland, one in Hillsboro, here in Salem, which is our main office. Physical office is also in Albany, Eugene, Roseburg, Grants Pass, Michigan, Klamath Falls, Coos Bay. Been doing this since 1978, exclusively bankruptcy since 1986. These are really difficult financial times. I'm the senior partner. Busy enough that Monday through Thursday night, I spend from 7 to 9, I spend every 15 minutes I'm talking to one of your constituents every night, new one, with financial difficulties. Not existing clients, new people. And I do it because my kids are raised and these people need help. The law has not been changed for exemptions since 1993. And to answer Representative Esquivel's question, trustees will do go after people that file bankruptcy if they have tools of trade that exceed the exemption. They don't like to do it, but they do it. They have to do it because that's what the law says, and they're governed by the United States Trustees Office, who supervises and insists that they do that. So this law needs to be changed. I'm going to give you two quick examples. I remember not too long ago, a good man down in Roseburg, he worked in a mill. He had saved his money and purchased a little portable sawmill. And with this sawmill, with his three teenage sons, he was able to work on the side and also make enough money to help support his family and keep the family home. He lost his job at the mill, and so he relied solely on this sawmill. Now, a portable sawmill is fairly expensive. Now, you pay $15,000, $20,000 for it. The day you pull it off the lot, it's worth a fraction of that. But it's worth a lot more than $3,000. Now, put yourself in my position. He comes to me because he's got his home's lost. He can't pay his bills, and he wants to keep the sole means of livelihood. What do I tell him? Oregon has a $3,000 exemption. Washington and California have higher exemptions. Also, they have the opportunity to take the federal exemption, so he could have clearly kept that sawmill. Now we know what to do to help them, but that's one example. Second example, a man in Oregon City. He worked for a dealership. Most mechanics that work for dealerships own their own tools. They buy them from Snap-on Tools, or they buy them from Mack Tools. The tools have guaranteed replacement value. They're easy to sell. He comes to me, I need to file bankruptcy. What kind of tools do you have? Well, I paid probably at least $10,000 for these tools. What could you sell them for? I could sell them tomorrow for $5,000. If we file a bankruptcy for this good gentleman with $5,000 worth of tools, the bankruptcy trustee will say, I want the $2,000 above the exemption. I could give other examples time after time. This is just one example, but I speak for people that don't have a voice, that are embarrassed to come before you and say this kind of thing, but I talk to them every day and every night. And they do need help, and this would generally help Oregon families. There's a lot of people that are getting self-employed nowadays, and this is a way for them to be able to keep their business, keep their livelihood, support their families, supports the economy, keeps them off the dole, helps them to pay for their bills. It's just healthy all the way around.
Thank you, Mr. Olson. Any questions or comments from Mr. Olson?
Okay.
Please.
Committee, thank you for your time. My name is Christopher Mertens. I'm an attorney at Todd Traveler & Associates, and our firm represents Oregon consumers and small business owners who are in financial distress with the goal of helping them get back on their feet and maintain their livelihoods. I'm here in favor of this bill because raising the exemption from $3,000 to $5,000 per individual will give small business owners a better chance of maintaining their livelihood while getting back on their feet. People that this bill will help the most are Oregonians with small businesses who may not have the means to organize a corporation or limited liability company and operate their businesses as sole proprietors or work as contract laborers. People such as subcontractors, specialized laborers, landscapers, auto mechanics, painters, and even artists. Oregonians who provide services that are required to earn a living and require tools and equipment in order to provide those services. Our firm sees people like this that would benefit from this bill's passage every day. Under the present exemption amounts of tools of the trade, Oregonians who own equipment that they use to earn their living that's worth more than $3,000 will, in fact, face the possibility that the equipment could be sold to satisfy their debts. Thus, the landscaper with the $5,000 tractor, who has had some tough winter months and slow, is being pursued by their creditors, may fall behind and lose that tractor to his aggressive creditors.
I hate that one, Adam.
I know. But loss of the equipment would mean losing his ability to maintain his livelihood, and that's exactly what we're talking about here today. When faced with the insurmountable debts where bankruptcy might be the only option for a fresh start, a sole proprietor who earns just enough to support his or her family and has equipment worth more than $3,000, which, as Co-Chair Schaffler obviously pointed out, that it's easy to have equipment that's worth more than $3,000 in today's economy. They may face the real possibility that that equipment would be liquidated as part of their bankruptcy. And that would leave the owner, again, without the means to continue supporting themselves and their livelihood. In addition to protecting ongoing small businesses, increasing the tools of the trade exemption will help encourage those with specialized skills to go out onto a trade on their own. This amendment will provide additional assurances that their investment in the equipment will be afforded some protections. Again, it's in the state's best interest to encourage small businesses as it contributes to local economy and lessens the possible burden on the state of other unemployed individuals. And as one final note, I'm personally familiar with the exemptions in Washington and California, as I'm licensed in those states as well. In each of those states, sole proprietors are afforded greater protections than in Oregon's current exemption amount, and this bill will help keep Oregon in some parity with the similar protections afforded to the citizens of our coastal neighbors. And it will send a message that Oregon's small business owners are important and vital to our state's economy. And thank you for your time.
Okay, Chair Schaffler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Gentlemen, I really appreciate all the things you're doing for work, for families out there, working families that are stuck. People say, well, you don't make much money at this job. You know, there's years when I was a contractor, right? I made less money than I'm making now. I made more money in the union than I ever did contracting, as far as that goes, and I didn't work as long, and I didn't have as much at risk, but I do appreciate it. But, Mr. Chair, I hope you and the committee will indulge me one more time. This state is in the way of working families going back to work by standing in the way of flexible land use for industry, water development, irrigation, siting, and building power facilities and the power lines and pipelines that go with it, and building a big, iconic bridge across the river and a long, growing, more timber, denying landlords the ability to mine gravel on their own property, and a long, growing list of obstacles to putting the good families in this state back to work. And the responsibility is sitting right here in this building, not on this committee, but in others. And there's a handful of people that are in critical positions that are obstacles to putting Oregonians back to work in this state. So, once again, thank you. And this is just a glaring example of what's happening. $5,000 worth of tools. Unbelievable.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any further questions or comments?
I may need to refer Chair Schaffler to my physician for high blood pressure medicine.
120 over 78, Mr. Chair. Last time I checked.
170 over what? Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you. Is there anyone else wishing to testify on Senate Bill 935? Seeing none, we'll close the hearing on Senate Bill 935. People ready to proceed with this bill?
Yes, absolutely.
Okay, we'll open a work session on Senate Bill 935.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 935 forward to pass recommendation.
Chair Schaffler moves Senate Bill 935 forward with the due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Seeing none. Is there any objection? Hearing none. So ordered.
Take our contractor friend down here. Yen should carry.
We will put the contractor friend, and Mr. Johnson, Representative Johnson,
Mr. Chair,
as carrier, please. And co-chair.
I want to give the good carrier warning that he's going to hear that speech again on the House floor while he carries the bill.
and I will likely respond, preach, brother, preach.
Thanks. Oh, my goodness. Okay, is there any further business come before us?
Seeing none, we are adjourned.
You and I have been doing